You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, September 13th, the feast day of St. John Chrysostom, so named because of his alleged golden mouth. I can claim no such thing. Maybe if they had a, I don't know, what's some cheap metal, aluminum mouth? I don't know. That would be me. Anyway, welcome in. No stainless steel Breadbox Media coffee cup today, so I'm going old school, which means my coffee will be cold in 10 minutes, but, you know, we're all playing hurt this time of year. I'm going to tough it out. I've set it down somewhere. I have a propensity of losing things. My father said if my head wasn't attached, I would lose it. No doubt sparked by a streak in which, among other things, I lost my brand new London Fog jacket that my mother had bought me. Left it on the back of a chair at school, never to be seen from again. But I think my coffee cup may be in my office somewhere. So I'll find it, hopefully, before I knock it over and spill coffee all over my papers. But anyway, I digress. Looking forward to the show today. At the bottom of the hour, Dr. Stephen Bullivant will be with us from across the pond over in the UK. Dr. Bullivant, who works with an organization or with an institution at St. Mary's University, where he is senior lecturer in theology and ethics. He is with the Benedict XVI Center over there and just received a large grant, the Benedict XVI Center did, in cooperation with a few other entities to study religious non-belief, I guess you could say. I like that idea because it puts out front what is a truth that oftentimes gets overlooked, and that is atheism itself is a type of belief, a type of faith. So they're going to be studying it. Stephen Bullivant having, I think, a personal perspective on that since he was formerly an atheist before he came to the Catholic faith. So we'll look forward to having him on the bottom of the hour. We'll also, as a part of that, talk a little bit about St. Teresa of Calcutta's alleged atheism and what made it different. So we'll get into that with him. Also, Regensburg 10 years later, Pope Benedict's most controversial statement coming 10 years ago yesterday at a lecture he gave in Regensburg. John Allen, in his column in Crux Now, revisiting Regensburg, that we might again discover what it really was about. We'll talk about Genesis 1 and false dichotomies. As you know, you're helping me formulate my thoughts in order to teach my high school students this semester, so bear with me. Also, a Latin phrase for Mr. Tim Kaine, vice presidential candidate, and the difference between seeing and seeing. Keep you guessing on that one. All that and more in the program today. Certainly welcome your calls. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response or thought on Facebook or on Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment, of course. We'll also spin the Dial of Catechism wheel. We will look back in history, and we will give out our What Were You Thinking Awards, all the features you appreciate or, at the very least, have grown to tolerate. All that and more on the program today. As I said, today the feast day of St. John Chrysostom. I wish, you know, tomorrow I'm having my friend Father Tom Galloway, Orthodox priest. John Chrysostom, very dear, particularly to those Orthodox Christians, certainly dear to us as Catholics as well. But I would love to hear his perspective. Maybe we'll have to ask him about that tomorrow. But he was the Archbishop of Constantinople in the late 4th and early 5th century, known for his preaching and public speaking. The name Chrysostom, as I said, means golden mouth in Greek and denotes his celebrated eloquence. I haven't read as much of John Chrysostom as I should. That's the beauty of being Catholic. There's always something new to read. and I need to get a little bit more familiarized. This is from Catholic culture. He was born in Antioch about 347 A.D. His powerful eloquence, as I said, earned him the surname of Chrysostom, or Golden Mouth, with St. Athanasius, St. Gregory Nazianzen, and St. Basil. He forms the group of the four great doctors of the Eastern Church, theological doctors, teachers. As Archbishop of Constantinople, his courageous stance against the vices of even the wealthy caused him to be exiled several times. He died in 407 AD, still in exile. In 1204, his body was brought to St. Peter's in Rome, but was returned to the Orthodox on November 27th, 2004, by Pope John Paul II. You know, I read that not only of his eloquence, but of his courage. Sometimes you have people who preach who are more in love with their own oration than they are with speaking truth. Perhaps they craft sermons meant to tickle the ears, to use a New Testament phrase. What you have to appreciate about John Chrysostom is he used his eloquence, his golden mouth, to challenge sin and corruption and call people to repentance. So maybe a little bit more about St. John Chrysostom a little bit later in the program. An interesting quote, by the way, from St. John Chrysostom, and this may be apocryphal. There's so many quotes attributed to people and to saints that there's really no evidence they actually said. It's almost embarrassing. And we can be as guilty as perpetuating it. You know, it's like the prayer of St. Francis, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace," which is an absolutely beautiful prayer. Certainly, you would think would be in the spirit of Franciscan spirituality, but the problem is, at least most of the stuff that I've read, there's really no evidence that St. Francis himself ever said it, nor the phrase, "preach the gospel at all times, when necessary, use words." So whether this is a quote that is definitely from St. John Chrysostom or not, I don't know, but I like it anyway. Well, on one level, I like it, and on another level, I don't. "Slander is worse than cannibalism," Chrysostom said. Ouch. Slander, you know, to ruin someone's reputation, to drag someone's name through the mud, is actually worse than cannibalism. I mean, most of us, I think, reason that cannibalism is beyond the pale of what we're capable of. And yet there are many times that we say ugly things about others. We say unnecessary things about others. Things that scar, via speculation, the reputation of someone who would otherwise count us as a friend. So St. John Chrysostom, pray for us. Pray for us indeed. If we read the gospel reading today, Jesus journeying to a city called Nain, his disciples and a large crowd accompanied him. We're in the Gospel of Luke chapter 7. As he drew near to the gate of the city, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Now, let's pause there just for a minute to reflect upon the circumstance that this woman finds herself in. He's the only son of his mother who was a widow. Now, in the ancient world, of course, a woman was significantly vulnerable on her own in the world. This woman who was a widow, now losing her only son, her only obvious means of support. So there were a lot of things that she was grieving today, that day. Certainly the loss of her son, which is something no parent should ever have to bear, burying their child. But in burying him, she was burying all her future hopes as well. And maybe like Jacob, the grieving parent in the book of Genesis, ready to go down to the grave with her son. A large crowd from the city was with her. And this phrase here in Luke's gospel, simple enough, innocuous enough, "when the Lord saw her, he was moved with pity for her and said to her, 'Do not weep.'" Now, there's a couple of things here. One, when the Lord saw her. just what I'm getting at when I said at the beginning of the show, that they're seeing and there is seeing. I mean, we pass people every day out on the street. We either have no idea what burden they're bearing. People are icebergs, you know. Or to be quite frank about it, we really don't care. We can't be bothered. But the Lord saw her. I think that word is very pregnant right there. That word saw. He saw her circumstance. He saw her desperation. He saw her grief. He saw her person. Was moved with pity. That word, I think, actually translates from an interior, guttural, visceral sense of compassion for her, and said to her, "Do not weep." Stepped forward and touched the coffin. Jesus, of all people, the only one who could say what would seem to be such insensitive words at a point of grief. Walk into a visitation. Don't cry, be joyful, right? Jesus could say, "Do not weep," because he was what he was about to do. He stepped forward, touched the coffin. The bears halted. He said, "Young man, I tell you, arise." Much as he would say, "Talitha kum," little girl, get up. And then I love how Luke writes it in his gospel. The dead man sat up and began to speak. And Jesus gave him to his mother. You know, there's a reason they call it good news. The dead man sat up. We'll be back with more, including the question of the day, on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. You are listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Tuesday, the 13th of September, feast day of St. John Chrysostom, St. Golden Mouth, pray for us. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, simply go to breadboxmedia.com. Lots for you to learn there, both about the purpose, why we exist in this digital enterprise of accompanying people, accompanying each other, really, on a journey deeper into the heart of Jesus and his unquenchable love and the truth about the church that he founded upon St. Peter and the apostles, the fullness of the faith that continues on down through the apostles and their successors over the century. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Listen to podcasts of our favorite shows. Discover new ones. Everybody with a different temperament, personality, and topic, all through the lens of the Catholic faith. You can also subscribe to podcasts through iTunes, Google Play, or Podbean, and become a friend of your favorite show. Wink, wink, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, and through a monthly contribution, receive access to exclusive online content. All that and more at breadboxmedia.com. A question of the day. I came across an article that talked about how, even though overall practice of the Christian faith in this country is on the decline in terms of percentages of people who attend church on a regular basis and so forth, but there does seem to be an exception for the mega church. The mega church, largely, not all of them, of course, but many of them, are becoming even more mega. So maybe it's a little bit like, you know, population in this country becoming centered around urban areas more and more. Or maybe it's something to do as well with the mindset that makes the big box store more appealing than the local five and dime. But for whatever reason, we as a people seem to be drawn to the big and the expansive, even when it comes to our churches. Now, as somebody pointed out, I think it was Mark Shea commenting on my question of the day, that he goes to a church with a billion members. Yeah, it's the original mega church, the Catholic Church. And if you doubt it, no, we're not talking about St. Peter's. We're talking about which is huge enough. We're talking about the worldwide 1-point-something billion member Catholic Church. You know, when Pope Francis, I believe, was in the Philippines, the only way to describe the crowds there, oceanic. So we know about we're the original mega church, as I said. But my question is, in terms of your local congregation, and I don't care whether you're Catholic, Protestant, whatever your stripe, given the choice, this is my question of the day, would you prefer to attend a church of 3,000 plus members or one with less than 300 members? And why? 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in on that question. 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Some responses we've gotten on Facebook. John says less than 300. Over 300 is starting to push, quote, "This is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of commerce situation." Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that running a large enterprise, a large congregation is, it is a very complicated scenario. It takes a lot of income and so forth, and can easily lose sight of the reason one exists. So that's an interesting perspective. Mary says less than 300, probably because that's the size church I grew up in, but also because I like knowing the people I go to church with. And also agrees, one with 300 or less, easier to get to know people. Now, we do have some counter voices on this. Mark says, "I have no preference. That was not always the case. I used to prefer smaller, but my parish, which I love, is over 4,000 families and the largest in the diocese. I love the opportunities for ministry I am afforded in this parish." Carrie says, "I love a big parish. I grew up in a huge parish, so I've tended to gravitate to larger parishes. 3,000 plus families is fine with me, and the main reason I attend the parish I do." That's when my friend Mark Shea chimed in. "I go to a church with a billion members, but they don't all attend at the same time." My friend Bruce says, "I love our smaller parish, but look forward to a larger one when we move to Lexington," which is, of course, where we broadcast from someday. So, you know, I can kind of see both sides here. When I was a Methodist pastor, 11 years ago, my congregation was a less than 300 member parish. I think we typically had anywhere from maybe 150 to 175 people attend on a Sunday morning, one service. There was a multi-generational interaction and a sense of community and family that we had in that congregation. But I've also been a part of, and my Catholic parish is a large parish. Not sure if we're 3,000 plus families, but I know we're not 3,000 plus families. I don't think we're 3,000 plus members, but you know, we're definitely over halfway there. So I think there are opportunities sometimes and resources that come with a large parish that a small parish can't have. But I think there's a place for both. I'm just asking your preference. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Two more games wrapping up the NFL weekend last night. Neither one of them close. So if you were looking for compelling football, last night was not it. The Steelers handled the Redskins 38-16. Got to start to wonder a little bit about the Jay Gruden era there in Washington. He's still a coach, isn't he, Alex? Yeah, Jay Gruden's still the coach. All right. And then the 49ers, who really were pretty miserable last year and they're in their first post-Harbaugh year, of course, with the new Chip Kelly as their head coach, with a 28-0 resounding defensive win shutout of the Los Angeles Rams, who won't be making the people of L.A. extremely happy with their new football team. But 49ers with a big win, setting up, I think, a showdown between them and the Panthers coming up this next week. And Cam Newton, who already faced one tough defense at Denver, can't be licking his chops at the prospect of facing what appears to be another stout defense. Evidently last night, though, I didn't see it. I was at my son's JV football game, which they unfortunately lost. If I sound a little tired this morning, it's because we didn't get back in until after 11. 4:45 a.m. came extremely early. Let me just say that. But missed the game, but did see that Colin Kaepernick continued to protest the anthem, and others now have joined him. Another sad revelation from this past weekend was RG3, the former quarterback of the Redskins, who's now found himself on the Browns. Of course, the Browns with a pretty dismal performance against the Philadelphia Eagles and their rookie quarterback, Carson Wentz, and evidently Robert Griffin III, injured. And we don't know how long he's going to be out. This has been the mark of RG3's career. Such promise, but he tends to be very fragile. But not only that, what makes it worse is he is taking risks he doesn't necessarily need to take. This is a story from The Guardian. Looks back on RG3's first NFL game where he laid a block downfield that so impressed people because he wasn't the typical wimpy quarterback. He was willing to go out there and lay it on the line for his teammates. But it just goes to show sometimes prudence is a more valuable football virtue than valor. Because when you're the quarterback, that's where you help your team, by being the quarterback. Not by bumping chests and then being injured on the sidelines. And, you know, it's a shame that he's had to learn this lesson, but doesn't seem like he's learned it, because who knows what's going to happen now with his career. And if you're a Browns fan, I mean, honestly, it's bad enough being a Kentucky football fan, and it's rough being a Tampa Bay Buccaneers football fan, even though we did win our first game, but being a Browns fan, pretty, pretty tough indeed. All right, let's move on to our What Were You Thinking awards. We got a few to hand out. Spanning the globe and finding the ultimate examples of human imbecility. You know, we're destined for greatness. We can also be destined through wrong choices, through dumb things. And number one nominee, artist covers 100-year-old house in pink crochet. Now, here in Lexington, where we broadcast from, there used to always be this house I'd pass on my way to school that was painted pink. I'm not sure it still is. But here's a little bit different take. A woman made a huge crochet blanket and completely covered her house. So here's my problem with that. This is the reason we have neighborhood associations. If you don't like draconian neighborhood associations, then don't make pink crochet blankets to throw over your house. That's all I'm saying. number two. Let's see. I thought I had this here. Our number two nominee, because I really want to save the winner for one that is worthy. Number two. Oh, yeah. School sorry after child wears Hitler costume to school. The child end up winning an award for wearing his Hitler costume. This was in Australia. There was evidently also a Jewish group visiting on that day. So not a good decision there, teach. But the winner we're going to give to is evidently this guy down in North Carolina who has been reporting evil clown sightings. Turns out he made it all up, David Wayne Armstrong. Aren't we creeped out by clowns enough without your shenanigans, sir? We'll be back in just a minute with Stephen Bullivant from across the pond about studying atheism. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Mm-hmm. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, September 13th. Pleased to be joined via England, Stephen Bullivant. Dr. Bullivant is Senior Lecturer in Theology and Ethics. He's the Director of the Benedict the 16th Center for Religion and Society and the Program Director for the University's successful MA in Theology. He joined St. Mary's following his studies in Theology and Philosophy at Oxford in 2009. He is an award-winning scholar and also the author of The Trinity, How Not to Be a Heretic from Paulist Press, Faith and Unbelief, which came out in 2014, The Salvation of Atheists and Catholic Dogmatic Theology. Hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right. It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we had you on a few months ago, so nice to get caught up again. Of course, you blog a lot of places, too, and Strange Notions, which is excellent, the digital Areopagus. But I was fascinated to see a story that the Benedict XVI Center, which you've been a part of, I guess, from the beginning there, has received a grant of £2.3 million for a three-year project on the theme Understanding Unbelief. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is $3 million from the John Templeton Foundation, which is obviously a U.S.-based grant-giving trust. And it's really a project. There's been a lot of interest in the past 10 years in atheism, in the new atheism, in non-religiosity in general, the rise of the nuns, particularly in America. And this is really the first kind of big-funded global attempt to understand and unpick some of the diversity there, some of the interest there, and also the changing dynamics, because there's always been this kind of idea that, you know, especially in America, that, you know, atheists or nuns are this certain type of person, that, you know, they're middle class men, white, you know, they're probably living somewhere like Portland, Oregon or somewhere like that. Well, actually, it's kind of 20 or more percent of the population now identify as having no religion in the States, then that's presumably going to change. I mean, it seems unlikely that like everywhere's becoming like Portland, Oregon. So one of the things that we're trying to do with this is look at the diversity and the cross-cultural differences in non-religiosity, and also things that I'm particularly interested in is how does being brought up Catholic change your nonness, if you like, compared to being brought up Baptist or to be kind of raised in a non-religious house. So there's huge questions, and this really allows us, the project team, to do some serious work ourselves, but also to give out grants to other researchers for them to do their own projects too.
Yeah, you know, I guess, and I'm no historian, but the rise of the nuns, the not the N-U-N-S, but the N-O-N-E-S,
and they're not rising so much.
Yeah, exactly. Those who, you know, forsake, I guess, not just religious involvement, but religious belief. I would imagine this is fairly unprecedented in the West.
Western Europe, we've had it a long time. In America, I mean, I think 1990, there was about 8% of the population said they had no religion. But, you know, probably only about a third of those would have said they didn't believe in God. By 2015, it was getting up for kind of 20-odd%. So that's really, that's the big story in American religion of the past, you know, kind of quarter decade, has been the rise of the nuns. In Britain, there was a lot of publicity recently. We put out a report about the proportion of nuns in Britain, which is kind of 50% of the population say they have no religion here, and that's quite normal in Western Europe. So the questions really are is how did that happen? You know, kind of 50, 60 years ago, that wasn't the case. And as even 20 years ago, 10 years ago, it wasn't the case in America, and all that's changed. And it's across the board. It's not a Catholic thing. It's not an Episcopalian thing. I think, you know, there's a huge number of books coming out now about reaching out to the nuns or how to keep the young and that kind of stuff. So this is a huge kind of cross. It's an ecumenical question, really.
You know, you're a Catholic. I'm a Catholic, and certainly in our Catholic understanding, and it talks about this in the Catechism, that the human being is sort of incurably religious. Is there a perspective here that atheism itself, or even unbelief, ironically enough, is a type of belief? I mean, you're with the Benedict the 16th Center for Religion and Society. Is there a sense in which atheism can almost involve a certain faith commitment as well?
Well, I certainly think it can. And this idea that, you know, you have created us for yourself, Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you is precisely the Christian anthropological approach to atheism. In fact, the Second Vatican Council's statement on atheism in Gaudium et Spes includes exactly that quotation from Augustine. And in fact, the Vatican, 50 years ago, the Vatican launched a huge conference, the first conference ever on the sociology of atheism. So the Catholic Church has form in this area, and it's precisely one of the things that we're trying to understand, and scholars across America and Europe and elsewhere are trying to do this, is to once kind of religious identity, religious belief goes or fades or becomes less important, less even for people who kind of still tick the box, it's less a big thing in their lives. Well, what takes its place? For some people, I think certainly their numbness becomes a very big part of who they are, their identity. And we've seen a growth of that, particularly with the new atheism, but that's just one phenomenon in recent years. But the question is that typical? When you get to kind of half a population saying they have no religion, are they all committed atheists with a capital A? Well, no, they're not. It's just that for a large number of people, that religion just isn't a thing that crops up in the kind of daily life, their daily thoughts. Now, that's not to say that there aren't kind of surrogates or replacements there in other areas, but what they are, we don't really know.
You know, I know that, and here we're with Dr. Stephen Bullivant, Senior Lecturer in Theology and Ethics and Director of the Benedict the 16th Center there at St. Mary's University, and talking about a grant they're receiving for studying unbelief. I guess this has a bit of a personal slant for you, since you at one time considered yourself an atheist.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I got into this kind of sociology of atheism from I started out at university as an atheist, fell into studying theology, ended up doing my postgrad work on the Catholic theology of atheism. I talked about Vatican II earlier, the council's engagement with atheism as a phenomenon, and particularly the question of the salvation of atheists. In the course of that research, I stopped being an atheist and became a Catholic. And then my own research, I mean, I do a lot of stuff on the new evangelization. I do a lot of stuff kind of on the theology of unbelief and non-religiosity. And I also do a lot of kind of useful and enriching, but to an extent independent work, kind of looking at kind of atheism in its own right, if you like. So for me, you know, this is hugely interesting for me personally and professionally, but also, of course, for me, I was raised as kind of a non. Wasn't baptized until I was well into my 20s. So for me to study, you know, the vast numbers of people who were brought up as, you know, Catholic or Mormon or Baptist, who now regard themselves as nones, I'm one of the ones who went the other way.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, G.K. Chesterton used to say that the first step toward becoming Catholic is being fair to the Catholic Church. Was that part of what happened with you and your academic study? You had perceptions, but then you began to consider the Church on her own terms and not the straw man that is often presented?
Yeah, high school. If the God delusion had come out when I was at high school, or, you know, The End of Faith by Sam Harris, that would have been it for me. You know, that was, you know, I was a pretty unpleasant. I mean, this is not a comment on atheists. It's a comment on me as a teenager. I was a pretty unpleasant atheist. And I gradually, first of all, began to realize that it wasn't nonsense, which I kind of thought as I kind of studied it, philosophy of religion and then studying theology. But also I began to be attracted to it. You know, I read the Gospel of Mark for the first time. I encountered the early church fathers. I read serious works of modern theology. And, you know, a kind of a slow intellectual process as a student, but also I started hanging out with Catholics. I knew seminarians. I had friends who were very committed Catholics, and being attracted to and socialized into a kind of a community, the two things kind of worked together, and surprised me really. And then my wife became Catholic a couple of years after me.
Oh wow. No, that's probably a topic for a whole other show, that dynamic. Now, you know, one of the things you may have found, and it sounds like maybe you found too, in becoming Catholic, that there are misperceptions that work the other way, that there are a lot of false perceptions of atheists that Catholics have. We're almost out of time for this segment. I'm hoping you'll be able to stick around, and maybe we could talk about those on the other side
Absolutely.
As well. I'm a former Protestant. After I became Catholic, I realized that a lot of Catholics have false views of some Protestants as well. So it can work both ways.
Absolutely. I think one of the big things with atheists is the definition of faith that gets put forward as kind of this irrational antipathy to evidence. And it just isn't what faith means in the Christian tradition. It's a type of trust.
Well, hold on tight. We'll be back in just a minute here with Dr. Stephen Bullivant of the Pope Benedict. We're canonizing him already. The Pope Benedict the 16th Center. We'll be back on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Before the hour here on the Mike Allen Show. I'm here with Dr. Stephen Bullivant, Senior Lecturer in Theology and Ethics and the Director of the Benedict the 16th Center for Religion and Society at St. Mary's University in England. He has just received a grant trying to get the figure here, Stephen. It's a large amount.
$3 million.
$3 million to study.
I don't know. After Brexit, we don't know what the exchange rate's like, but I think it's about $3 million.
To study religious non-belief, and a very personal thing in some ways for him, being a former atheist who became Catholic. We were talking a little bit, Stephen, about the tendency of atheists to have sort of false perceptions of Catholicism, but I'm sure there are many Catholics, maybe cradle Catholics or even convert who were Christians before, who sort of make caricatures of atheism. When the truth is, the temptation to atheism has been, is a natural human impulse. We shouldn't belittle it because it's a hard world to live in, and sometimes there are things that cause one's faith to wobble.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the John Paul II talks about the problem of evil as the bedrock of atheism. And also, I mean, I think the tendency of Christians, especially when Christianity has been kind of assumed and kind of almost everyone is a Christian, is to assume that it's just kind of common sense, that kind of, all right-thinking people would obviously believe this. But actually, and we see this in the early church, the Christian proclamation is an astonishing thing to be, suggesting that God himself, becomes an actual human baby and grows up and gets himself killed. God has been murdered, as St. Melitus of Sardis says in the second century. And actually, the kind of the scandal of the Christian proclamation is something that is very easy for people kind of brought up with it to just kind of like nod along to and kind of, just take as normal. But actually, if you're not raised with that, especially if you're not raised in cultures where that's taken seriously, then actually the kind of the full force of what Christianity is proposing can either make you kind of think it's crazy or make you so attracted and excited by it that you kind of want to, take up your cross and follow him. And I think we see that in the early church, because obviously Christianity, was regarded as this crazy thing, but that people, did follow it in heroic ways, which encouraged others. But I think we're beginning to see it, especially probably more in Europe. This kind of cultural Christianity, this background Christianity, is waning. So especially the young people, if you're in your 20s and going to mass, then you've been swimming against the tide for years within your schools, within your own families, and the people you meet at mass have been doing the same. So I think we're beginning to see this kind of resurgence in British Catholicism.
And it becomes an opportunity to move beyond that sort of cultural Christianity to really understanding what it is to be a disciple in a world that may think you're crazy.
Yeah.
Let's talk for just a minute. There was a great piece in the Catholic Herald that I think was drawn and adapted from a chapter in one of your books. The name of the article, The Truth About Mother Teresa's Atheism. Of course, she recently canonized as St. Teresa of Calcutta. And there was, of course, a revelation back in 2007, the publication of her private writings in the book Come Be My Light, that portrayed her own struggle with interior spiritual darkness. There were atheists who jumped all over that as a sign of her hypocrisy, but you take a different tack on that.
Oh, absolutely. So, in fact, in many ways, one of the most amazing things about Mother Teresa is that we find from these diaries and letters that for the vast majority of her adult life, she lived with what for anyone else would have been this kind of crippling sense of desolation in the absence of God, and this feeling of being abandoned. She said at one point that the place of God in my soul is blank. And this was punctuated by very profound religious experiences when Jesus talks to her, and tells her to leave the Loreto sisters and found the Missionaries of Charity. And I think it was the contrast between the two. I mean, the sort of the heights she scaled. But also the depths she felt. And the remarkable thing with Mother Teresa, and probably the lesson to be drawn here, because this is, Mother Teresa is probably an extreme example, but, this kind of feeling of abandonment or desolation is quite common among, even many of the greatest saints of the Church, John of the Cross, Therese of Lisieux, Padre Pio, Gemma Galgani, Paul of the Cross. But a lot of ordinary Christians have these moments, either long periods or kind of instants, if you like, of this feeling that God isn't there or God isn't listening. And the remarkable thing about Teresa is this inspired her all the more to find Christ in two places. In the poor, following Matthew 25, that's what she's most famous for, but in the Eucharist too. And she talks very profoundly about the link between meeting Christ in the altar and meeting Christ in the poor, in the dying, in the dispossessed. And it becomes clear when you read her writings that so much of this was driven, this thirst she had, and I thirst becomes the motto that I think is up on in the chapel of every Missionaries of Charity chapel, is this longing for Christ that she doesn't feel, but she's convinced that Christ is in the poor and he is in the Eucharist. So even if she's not getting warm fuzzies from it, if you like, she's not feeling, great coming out of Mass or whatever, but she knows he's there and she seeks him out. And it's this constant seeking Christ, despite kind of not getting much back. It's a thick book, and I read it several years ago when it came out, and kind of academically, because obviously a lot of my interests are in to do with faith and atheism and unbelief, and so it ties in very nicely with that. But you know this, Mike, and I've been suffering for the past couple of months with depression, which kind of came out of the blue, and I'm still dealing with it. And But again, I wrote something to the Catholic Herald on this as well, maybe 6 weeks back. But for me to reread this has been very difficult because it's harrowing stuff. But also just inspiring and just so impressive that someone who could feel this, you know, doesn't just stay in bed watching old episodes of Mork and Mindy, which is kind of, you know, all I felt able to do sometimes. But just...
That was a good show, but I
oh, absolutely,
I was like...
yes. But it's probably going to get me canonized.
Well, you know... The bad thing, I think, or the what makes the cross of depression for a Christian even more difficult is not only are you dealing with the darkness of depression itself, but almost maybe an interior guilt. Well, where's my faith? Do I, you know, I should be having joy and so forth.
Yeah.
But as you know, if anything, maybe Saint Teresa can be a patron saint of those who find themselves in this darkness, to know that it is not a disqualifying reality of the authenticity of faith or sainthood, but this experience of listlessness, of darkness, of abandonment, of emptiness can actually be its own path to holiness.
Well, absolutely. And again, remember that, you know, Teresa's, you know, most famous for the materially poor and reaching out to them, but she spoke constantly about the lonely. She always talked about especially in the West, the loneliness of people, and that this was, you know, as profound a poverty as kind of not having enough to eat. And I think, you know, she didn't talk about this herself publicly, but I think, you know, looking back and reading it, she was clearly, you know, speaking out of some of her own experiences here.
And for those to jump on these revelations of these letters as some sort of a critique, you know, as you know, Christopher Hitchens was all over this sort of thing. It is a very much a caricature and a simplistic understanding of faith, and I think really reveals a lack of understanding of what authentic faith really is.
Oh, absolutely. And again, this isn't, I mean, for anyone who, I mean, to be fair to outsiders, you know, the Christian mystical tradition, you know, is quite, it shouldn't be, but it's quite a niche area. But I mean, anyone who's familiar with kind of the interior of Christianity knows that this is a very well recognized often part of holiness. I mean, the dark night of the soul, you know, was regarded by, you know, the kind of the spiritual masters as one of the stages on the way to kind of holiness. And in the Gregory of Nyssa in the 4th century, in his Life of Moses, talks about how as Moses ascends Mount Sinai into the presence of God, he goes through a dark cloud, because I think the scripture talks about, you know, the dark cloud where God was, and talks about Moses finding God in the darkness. So this is deeply embedded within Christianity and Christian spirituality. It's not well known. It's not something we talk about very much. I think you're right that so much we tend to think of of kind of Christian spirituality as feeling good.
That's right.
You know, which it can be. Oh God, it can be.
But sometimes not.
Always.
Stephen, yeah. We're out of time, unfortunately. Blessings to you in the Benedict XVI Center with this study. I think this is going to be a great benefit, and I'll be praying for you. Appreciate you sharing honest journey as well, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime.
Love to.
Take care. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.